Hello and welcome. I'm Patrick Curtis, your host and chief monkey, and this is the Wall Street Oasis podcast. Join me as I talk to some of the community's most successful and inspirational members to gain valuable insight into different career paths and life in general. Let's get to it. In this episode, member JDS07 shares her path to joining a top private equity fund as an analyst right out of undergrad. We cover a wide range of topics in this episode, including what she learned during her bulge bracket investment banking internship and why she wanted to skip investment banking to go straight to PE, what she's seeing in the deal landscape, how her firm does diligence and how she is specifically involved, and also detailed advice on how to prepare for the super competitive private equity recruiting process. Enjoy. JDS07, thank you so much for joining the Wall Street Oasis podcast.
It's my pleasure, Patrick.
Yeah. So
I've been part of the community for a while, so very happy to be able to share my background.
Awesome. Yeah. So could you give the users and the listeners a just quick summary of where and kind of where you came from and what you're doing now?
Yeah. So I originally was an immigrant, currently now a citizen. Grew up in a few different places and went to a target school based in the Northeast. There, I participated on on-campus recruiting, got an internship with the Bulge Bracket Bank in a well-known investment banking group, did my summer internship there, but decided to transition full-time to direct private equity, which is what I want to do. So now I'm with a pretty well-known firm. We just raised our fifth fund, doubled our fund size from a previous fund, and have been looking at a bunch of companies in a broad array of industries.
Great. So you kind of skipped banking altogether. So you did it over the summer. Was there something about that experience that made you not want to do it? Or did you always know you wanted private equity?
So I always knew I wanted to do private equity. And for me, it was a choice between getting into private equity out of undergrad with a really good analyst program, as well as a really good firm and have the attach on that later, or going back to banking and doing my typical 2 years. My thought process then was really centered around the fact that I think if I can do private equity earlier, it not only gives me a better leg up over my peers in investment banking and just knowing how to think like a private equity investor, knowing how to do due diligence on the company and the things that a person in PE would really focus on versus, I think, the banking experience, which is still very valuable, but focuses a bit more on the marketing side of selling a company and less around of the intricacies of diligence and post-integration work.
Do you feel now that you've kind of been working for a year in PE straight out of undergrad, do you feel that you're missing anything? Do you feel like there was enough training at your firm where you felt comfortable? Like, are you actually running, doing LBO modeling? Did you do enough of that kind of in undergrad, or you feel a little bit like you're still ramping up there?
Yeah. You know, I think in PE, there's definitely the sense that you might have simply fewer deals. Now I'd caveat that with knowing a lot of my friends are still in banking. They have many deals that don't close and many deals that really go nowhere. And there is that similar feeling to you because in the private equity firm, you're not really buying a lot of companies every year. My firm especially, we buy around 2 to 4 companies a year and we're very careful with where we put our capital. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, there might be a similar sense of just you spend a lot of work doing due diligence on a company and a deal and it doesn't really go through. On the flip side, I think the amount of work and the kind of work I'm doing in PE is vastly substantial than what I did back in my internship at banking and also what I saw the first and second year analysts were doing then. I say this because, you know, here I'm really owning all the models. I'm owning all the diligence streams. And these get very complex. In banking, oftentimes you're just taking one template and you're making some smaller changes to it. I mean, in my group, we had one humongous M&A, the merger model template that essentially has comms, has LBO, mm-hmm. it has DCF, and you really, it really is a matter of often just changing some tickers and changing some numbers and everything that flows through. Here, all the companies look at, even if it's a company, you know, with a very similar business model as when we looked at before, we're typically always building our models from scratch. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a different way of building things. And so here, the learning opportunity is just a lot more. And I found that also senior data members give you more time to explain their views on companies, on industries. And there are a lot more nuances that we bake into our models as well. Things around tax distributions, you know, various kinds of more complex, like maybe unit level modeling, you know, mm-hmm. more complicated revenue bills and so forth that I just haven't really seen.
Like basically the operating models are more complex, more detailed. And
yeah, it's far more complex. And the cases are far more nuanced because
it's your money at stake. It's your money at stake.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And you know, the LBO mechanics are the same no matter what. So, you know, whether or not you're growing EBITDA at 5%, and here we really focus on the flow through mechanics.
Right.
Or you're, you know, growing sales like 2%, that makes a huge difference in your returns in your model.
So sorry to interrupt, but it sounds like you made the transition fairly easily then, like not just having the internship at the Bulge Bracket Bank where you were doing, like you mentioned, more of the templated models and stuff like that, to actually having to build something from scratch. It wasn't a hard transition from you. You had enough training, you felt you felt confident, or you ramped up fast enough, or was there something you felt like, okay, I'm in trouble, like, and you just had to learn by trial by fire kind of thing?
Yeah, I think it's a mix of really a ladder and just a quicker ramp. I can honestly tell you that, especially because I was in a very niche group in my Bulge Bracket Bank, none of the models that I was looking at or dealing with really applicable here. Even on the operating model side, the way that we build our operating models here for consumer retail companies is far more complex and far more nuanced than a simple revenue assumption build. So that was something we really had to ramp up and learn. On the LBO model side, we also have a very complex LBO model built that typically people utilize in certain ways. So that's not something I've seen in, you know, either the Wall Street Oasis materials or other materials online. So all this kind of had to learn by myself and with some help as well from, you know, senior associates at the firm. But I would say it's typically at my firm, you're given as much as you can prove that you can chew on. And if I just want to say, hey, I want to get this modeling rep, or I want to have the experience doing this, then you're typically able to get this experience. And that's been a really valuable part of my growth here.
And I assume that's because you guys are coming right out of undergrad. They understand you're just, quote, you're not like a pre-MBA associate, you're an actual analyst, you know, coming right out of school. So they are a little bit more supportive, or have you talked to other friends at other similar kind of private equity analyst programs? Is it similar?
Yeah, I think it's, I should say that there aren't that many well-known private equity analyst programs, period.
Right.
I have talked to a couple of friends who are somewhat transitioning to one, and I can say that I feel like their job is often not as technical. What I found is that, and I, during my recruiting process, I interviewed with probably 7 or 8 private equity firms for analyst positions. I found that a large handful of them have more sourcing oriented tasks, like maybe 40% of our time will be spent on sourcing deals, which is not anything we do here. I mean, none of the junior people do any amount of sourcing, really.
Yeah, you're not trying to make connections with founders. You're actually just doing getting the deals are coming in through the partners, and then you're actually analyzing them, or through bankers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And we might actually be proactive and reach out, or we might use some of our own resources to leverage this, but really 99% of the time it's all completely just you know, coming down from the senior members of the firm. And I also think that we are also very big on data. So we recently used Alteryx platform, we used Microsoft BI, we used Tableau, and very different kinds of data visualization tools. We're also buying consumer credit card information and tying this with how we're seeing how consumers might be spending their dollars on competing businesses. So we're actually driving a lot of our analytics using data. And I think as a result of that, we do very extensive due diligence.
Are you hiring outside consultants for those very deep dives, like data analysts or data scientists, or are you having to learn that? Like, are you an expert in Tableau now? Or are you an expert in this data analytics or Python, or are you bringing in other people to help you manipulate it?
Yeah, so we used to have outside consultants, but we found that, you know, they were really expensive, and this is something that probably the firm should not do. So we brought on someone as our head of data analytics, and we have trainings for everyone at the firm, especially for analysts and associates, to learn and leverage these skills. And I can tell you, so we have people kind of coming and teaching us about Alteryx and partially figuring things out as we do deals, but it's been really helpful. We've been able to just do a lot more data dissections in a much faster way through utilizing these resources. And we really just do a lot of due diligence. I mean, it's oftentimes like a leave no stones unturned process. And I think that's been the most valuable learning, even beside the modeling, because all of our learnings from these analyses are what gets put as input in our model. And that's what better informs us about,
you know,
how we think about the company's, you know, financial health.
Yeah, I'm really kind of surprised. I guess when you get further along in a process, it's important to do all those deep dives. But from what I've heard, oftentimes it's outsourced. Oftentimes it's more kind of just checking the boxes. And then what really comes down to is the deal dynamics. Like, are you actually able to win an auction of some sort, because there's so much capital chasing so few deals. Are you guys finding that prices are just like, you're losing a lot of auctions and you're just not able to, even after you've done all that work, that you lose a lot of deals because you're so analytical and you're finding the valuations too high?
That's a great question. What we found is that definitely, you know, here everything nowadays is north of 12 times usually. What we found typically is that if we find that this is a really compelling asset, we are not afraid of bidding up to 16, 17 times. But it really, all of this has to kind of be backed down by the data and how much we feel like we can really drive the company's value. So my firm is very much operationally focused. We're not a kind of PE firm that goes in and just calls a bunch of people or do any kind of financial engineering. And we are very well regarded in the space that we play in. So oftentimes, we might try to play some kind of games to maybe bid enough to get into the next round. And then after we do extensive business due diligence and hire third parties, and we find that this is still an asset we really, really want to own, then we would race the finish line. And we typically move through a process pretty fast. Okay. I think the past, there have only been a couple of times when we have been beaten out by a party for asset that we really, really wanted and just refused to match their price. And
right,
those were typically times when
the strategic came in or something.
A very special kind of firm who would essentially just outbid everyone and preempt the process entirely without anyone's knowledge. And that's happened a few times, but typically if we lose a process, it's because we just felt like where this asset will ultimately end up trading at is not where we think we can get a very high return that we're trying to underwrite. You know, are we wrong? Are we right all the time? No, but I think we've typically hit a lot of these points of the mark. Since we've seen a lot of companies that we've looked at in the past come back to auction again. That's been a kind of interesting process to see whether or not we made the right choice in passing on the company.
Yeah, that's always fascinating when you can look back and be like, well, I'm glad we didn't get that deal done, or I'm happy. I wish we had gotten that one. Right. Hindsight's 2020, but real quick, I'd also like to when you're paying up to those types of multiples for these businesses, obviously there's some strong growth prospects and the like, are you able to get much more leverage? I know back when I was in private equity, you know, things were closer to trading around, 8 to 12 times, not 15 to 17. And that was still considered, booming time. It's, 15 to 17, maybe you're dealing with slightly smaller companies that are faster growing, but are you able to, are the banks coming along for this and allowing you to keep your equity checks small? Are they coming in at, 6, 7, 8 times? Or are they staying conservative, and how is that kind of capital structure shaking out in terms of how these deals are being closed?
Yeah, you know, I think we've typically been able to lever, say we're buying a company at 12 times, we've typically been able to lever it up to at least 6 or sometimes even 6.5 times.
Mm-hmm.
Our own portfolio companies, we're actually really good at getting very low rates for our debt. And I can tell there have been some companies that we've even proposed levering up to ultimately 8 times. So mm-hmm. That's kind of 8 to 10 times, and that's really outside the norm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we found that generally the lenders are pretty bullish alongside their key partners, and that might also be just part of wanting to do, you know, get a slice of the pie.
This late in the cycle, is there any sort of fear or pullback, or is there any sort of cooling on that, or are people kind of just plowing right ahead? And this is, you know, June 2019 we're talking here, so are people a little nervous with all the you know, the trade wars and all this stuff going on that's kind of creating a little bit of fear in the market? Is that kind of translating to debt and private equity or no?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of that, and so the conversation that we usually have with lenders when we're asking them to take a look at the company with us is typically around the cash flow profile of the company and just its general stability.
Mm-hmm.
And we always kind of model a sort of downside case as well, and we also model a sort of a more upside case. And I think what we found is that if we think that this company can really sustainably be levered at 6.5 times, then we're able to convince lenders to get us there. If we don't even think that we would be comfortable levering this thing at 6 times, maybe it's more 5.5 times,
mm-hmm.
Then lenders will typically be more comfortable, because we are really trying to not, our goal is to not kind of maximize our equity upside of the company at the risk of leaving the company with zero cash. We typically want the company to have some cash left over for accretive M&A opportunities
mm-hmm.
or, you know, other kind of initiatives.
Yeah.
So usually the levers that we're aiming at is pretty much within the ballpark of a lender, I would say. And if we feel like we can be more aggressive with this deal because this company is, you know, securitized and has steady cash flow even during the last recession, then I think we'd be pretty comfortable with levering up like maybe 7-8 times and can kind of get some of the lenders on board at least. So
and you could be more aggressive. With this,
we just haven't seen that much that many issues yet, and I don't think the lenders or even us at this point, we feel like company valuations, at least intra valuations, will suddenly tank because we think there might be a recession in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
What might get really much affected is how the company's cash flow profile might change and how that affects your ultimate exit multiple and the sort of market, market fever there. But mm-hmm. at least on the interest side, we've really seen, then the lenders have been like, oh, well, we think, you know, next year elections, Trump, who knows what will happen. We don't want to, we are afraid of putting out this much debt on the company. There hasn't been anything like that.
Okay, that's interesting. Thanks for sharing. So in terms of, let's go back a little bit, talk a little bit about your recruiting, because you mentioned a little bit about how a lot of the private equity analysts' recruiting processes were more about like sourcing. Specific interviews, were they asking you to like actually do mock, I've heard from some of these sourcing places where like they'll have you do a mock call for like a CEO and see how you sell them or introduce yourself. Did they have you do any of that type of stuff? Or was it LBO modeling tests? Was it all fit? It'd be great to get some specifics that we could share with the listeners around the private equity interview process for coming straight out of undergrad.
Yeah. So I think, I should say on the technical side, very few would even have you sit down for a full model test. That's typically for the associate stage. And that's also part of the reason why I want to get into private equity earlier, because the associate interviews are so much tougher. At my firm, for example, the associates are basically sat down in front of a blank Excel and asked to build a three statement model, come up with a sort of case study, given a sim of a past company we invested in for 3-4 hours and just go from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
Typically what I found is that throughout the firms I interview with, it's a lot more of first talking about your summer initial experience. And that's a very big part, especially if you interned at an investment bank or you interned in consulting. So talking about your deals and being able to articulate the pros and cons of a particular any kind of M&A deal, why you would invest in a company, why you would not invest in a company. And then a lot of questions were centered around,
how did you prepare for that?
What
specifically, like how did you prepare? Like do you just review your deals before you go into that? So after the summer of your IB internship, you're like, okay, I have private equity analyst interviews coming up. I'm just going to review my deals. Did you prepare like cheat sheets? How did you kind of get ready to think as an investor rather than as a banker?
Yeah. So I wrote out a very long guide about my deals, kind of all the financial metrics there, the relevant metrics, revenue, EBITDA. And I had a pitch that was sort of a final project. So it wasn't anything live, but I was able to spin it as if it were a real deal that I did a pitch on and really talk about, you know, synergies, financial metrics and qualitative and quantitative metrics for why this would make sense.
Yeah.
And also risk factors that might arise as well as any mitigants to it. It's also good if you just simply talk about the fact that, oh, it didn't go through because XYZ didn't make sense, or we didn't feel like this was really achievable given this company's focus or given this company's geographic exposure or given
customer concentration, or where
customers are or where the microeconomy is. So it's really thinking about all aspects. It's both as in combining what you would do for a consulting interview, and then what you would with all the financial metrics.
I call that,
and also
that specific deal, I call them deal cheat sheets. We actually started including them in the private equity interview course, like samples from actual people who broke into private equity. I think it's probably the single biggest improvement we've made, because that's the most important thing, is that you have your deals locked down and you can talk about them intelligently. You know, everyone freaks out about the LBO modeling test, but I guess, especially in your case where you're interviewing for a private equity analyst a lot, you don't even have to, 99 times out of 100, you're not even getting a test, right? They're seeing, can you talk intelligently?
Yeah, I would say you have a 50% chance of getting either a paper LBO or a sort of
case.
Mini consulting case study.
Yep.
Where the case study would be where they give you the mind centered around a few choices. You know, company wants to, or it would be something like, oh, should we invest in a company? The company has 3 gross revenues. Here are some figures. The first, should we invest in a company? Second question would be, if we do invest in a company, what which option should it take? And you'll talk about the pros and cons of each. Mm-hmm. So you both have to arrive at some kind of sometimes IR or NPV number, but you also have to really think strategically about this opportunity and be able to articulate reasons on both the positive and negative sides for it. So I just think it's really kind of half and half, either getting that or the paper LBO. I'd probably say paper LBO is easier to prepare because it was really straightforward. There's not that many steps you can. You know, you have to have a certain amount of information just to be able to even do it. And it's oftentimes a check in the boxing. The case study, and I can even say that for this case study, I wasn't actually able to arrive at the final numerical answer because I could not compute kind of NPV just mentally. But I was able to really articulate really well and say that, hey, if I have Excel or if I have a calculator in front of me, I would be able to get you to the exact answer. But that aside, this is a solution I would recommend. I think overall P interviews.
Oh, so when they had you do the case, when they had you do the case, they didn't let you do it in front of Excel to get like an IRR or a multiple on invested capital or anything like
No, it was very much, and these are very much of a, they will just give you numbers.
Okay.
And they'll sit in front of you and just give you numbers. And you're expected to either do some quick mental math or you're going to write it down on a piece of paper.
Like,
and
you know, what's the cash flow coming out?
The consulting feeling comes in.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So some rough math and that's where it helps to have some sort of rough idea of what IRR or what.
Because it's typically asking you, this is to test your intellectual horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
So analyst programs, they're not expecting to know a lot of things as you would if you were recruiting for an associate position, regardless of whether or not you actually know anything. But for analyst programs, it's typically about just how do you think and how much do you feel we can load your brain with information to have you still arrive at sensible conclusions about investment and how much we can trust you to run analysis independently, provide thoughtful responses to our answers. And I found that especially at my firm, we're all given an opinion, a voice. I have been on the other side of listening to bank pitches and have had my managing director ask me what I think of the pitches, how I would compare these, where there are strengths and weaknesses, and actually implement some of my suggestions. So as a result of that, and the fact that we're still a pretty fairly lean team, although we're medium-sized as an organization, you just have to be very much on your feet and be a quick thinker, and you cannot just kind of rely on other people to feed you answers all the time. So that's why I think in the same way with associates, but add like a huge step up in responsibility to be able to lead deals and check analyst works. So on that front, it's definitely just a lot more kind of focus on semi-consulting thinking and being faster with feeding.
Great. So anything else on the recruiting process before we get off of that in terms of for the analysts? So you shared a little bit, but was there anything unexpected that you found when you went through the process?
I think one should always have some views about industries that they like and industries they don't like, and be able to have some examples of companies that they with characteristics that would fit their rationale. Mm-hmm. So what I find oftentimes is many people ask you, well, so if this is a firm with a more specialized strategy, they would ask, why would you like our strategy? Why do you think we are able to compete for deals better than our competitors? Mm-hmm. Why do you think XYZ industry is not a good industry for us to invest in? And you need to have a very, you cannot just give very general answers. It needs to be pretty specific. Mm-hmm. And what would be good is to give examples of companies in those sectors that you can use for examples.
Interesting. And so,
and I think that's like a very big part of the interview process.
And so when you were preparing for these interviews, you would look at portfolio companies that the fund had invested in, or how would you do that specifically? How would you prepare for that?
Yeah, so my preparation strategy came onefold with at least a week before, I would just read a lot of Wall Street Journal articles, Financial Times, a lot of industry news, and just have a view generally on the type of all the industries that the company plays in and the types of industries that are even adjacent to its portfolio companies. Mm-hmm. And I typically pick a couple of them. I'm not going to, you don't really have time to go through all the portfolio companies, but pick a couple that seem interesting to you that you feel like you either are really interested about the space or you can talk about it a bit more in detail and be able to use these examples during your interview. So every single private equity firm I've interviewed at, to some degree, they would ask you, well, tell us about a portfolio company of ours and why do you think we invested in this company? How do you think it might do in the future? What are some risks you see for this company in this industry? Because you don't really have any financials. You don't really know how they're really doing, which is very good, actually, because if these were public companies, then you would be expected to know everything about it.
Right.
And so you just want to have a really, informed view of how you think this company's, exposure to XYZ or certain geographies or might be over-indexed to certain population might impact other things. There's really much of a chain reaction thinking there, but you need to be able to say it in a very concise manner. And again, it's very good that these are oftentimes private companies with fewer financials.
Oh yeah, it'd be a nightmare otherwise. It'd be a nightmare.
It would be, right? And,
yeah.
And so you just want to have a view on a few companies. I have had interviews with private equity firms where they would ask me literally for three portfolio companies of theirs and to be able to talk in depth about them. It would be like, okay, tell us about a portfolio company of ours that you like and all the reasons why you like it and don't like it. And then it would be, tell me a second one and then tell me a third one. And then they would even ask you sometimes, what portfolio company of ours do you think is the worst of the lot? Why? And which one do you think is the best? And
you better hope that whoever you're interviewing with, that wasn't like their baby or their deal, right?
I have actually had a chance where I mentioned you know, I think this company might be the worst of a lot. And it actually ended up being my interviewer's pro company. But some of the reasons I said for why I think this company might have more headwinds than other before companies were spot on.
Yeah.
So that turned to be a nice conversation. But if you're wrong, that might be quite embarrassing if this ends up being, you know, the biggest hitter. And I think this is less common. So this kind of what's the best, what's the worst is less common. I've only had that a couple of times.
Right.
So I wouldn't be as worried. And as well, if the company has like 40 portfolio companies, you should not expect that kind of question. It would be impossible for you to
right.
even be able to, you know, search up each company for 20 minutes and have a view on them when they're just so different. But it really, you know, all PE firms like that you really like their portfolio companies. And if you don't, it's fine to be honest,
mm-hmm.
but you need to give very thoughtful answers and be open to pushback from them. And yeah. that actually might be a good way to make yourself stand out, I think. You can say, well, you know, I love that, but phrase it in a softer way so that you don't come off as saying that, oh, I don't like your firm strategy or the company you invest in. But that might be a way to stand out, actually, because everybody will be talking about
how amazing their
the
deals
most
are.
Obvious
yeah.
points.
Right.
Yeah. So it, that's just a way, I think, to stand out. I was really the only one hired of my year.
Mm-hmm.
with my firm. So, and I know that it was also a really competitive process that was going against a few other investment bankers and a few other NBB consultants, you know, who had internships. And I think what really made me stand out was just being able to articulate my view of their strategy really well and prove that I have a very solid understanding of why they invest the way they do.
That's great. I think that's really important and something the listener should take heed is just being able to be prepared for that specific interview, that specific fund, rather than going in and just only focusing on yourself and why, you know, the generic questions that you know you're going to get of why private equity, why, you know, or why growth equity or not.
Yeah. And I think what also helped me, and this is what I did for every single fund that I interviewed with, I created a little tracker.
Mm-hmm.
I would take some of their portfolio companies that I felt like were interesting. Just pick a couple that, you know, I really understand and feel like I can speak at length about. And then I would try to find news on these companies and what they've done. So, for example, I was able to say in one interview, okay, you guys are really you guys like to be value add partners to management team. I really bring a lot of expertise on add-on acquisitions. I've noted that you guys have done X number of acquisitions in the first 3 years post investment on your portfolio companies, you know, and being able to cite these statistics just really shows your interest in the firm, because they will be like, oh, well, this shows you actually doesn't work. And it's really simple. I mean, you have their name, you could just do some Googling and see what news come up and just kind of like track how these companies have done or what initiatives they've really started. And you can kind of attribute that to the success. And
it just shows you've done your homework and you come in looking more knowledgeable, looking more serious, and it just probably puts you ahead of a lot of the competition and gets you, it almost guarantees you you're going to be one of the final group.
Exactly. And there's also, they also ask you a lot of behavior questions. That's even far more than banking behavior questions, because they want to make sure you're a cultural fit.
Any tough
Most
ones that were
really small.
Yeah. Any tough ones that were unexpected or anything odd you had during that recruiting period?
Yeah, I think honestly, I never really prepare for behavioral questions. I really just have it down for my top, you know, my strengths and then maybe two weaknesses.
Mm-hmm. Did you have stories that you would pull from for those strengths rather than saying, I am a hard worker, I am so blah, blah, blah. Would you kind of try to layer in stories? Okay. Yeah, because I always tell 100% candidates to do that. Yeah,
right. You always have to say, well, you know, my story might be like, well, look, you know, I'm a really hard worker. Give an example, and then when I was in school or when I was growing up,
mm-hmm.
you know, give examples. Yeah. That really just shows the fact that you are. This is, you know, who you are, and for your weakness as well. You always want to tailor to, you know, and recognize that I have this weakness, and then it's usually something that's not, you know, quote unquote, a real weakness. But since then, I focus on improving this area through XYZ, and you know, just, it's a very simple kind of a 20-second answer, but you're, that's almost like a check in the box thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
That you were able to just had that, you know, had that be done with. What's also really useful is to be able to kind of guide the interview as much as you can. And you can do that through trying to find some commonalities with your interviewers, or in some cases, and this doesn't really happen with all interviews, being able to tailor an answer and turn that into a question afterwards and turn that into a discussion. Then it goes really smoothly and you're able to control what you guys are talking about, and also less than time for them to ask you some question.
Can you give me an example of that? So you're talking about, like, so, just try to, if you see that they're going a specific direction, kind of just try to take that and kind of run with it. Or is there a specific example you could give us? Because I agree with you, but that's a skill that I don't think is obvious to a lot of people.
Yeah, it's definitely not, it's not the easiest to do. And I have also encountered situations where, if it looks like it's going to be a question, the interviewer might say, that's a good question, but let's save that for the end when you ask me some questions, and then kind of go off their reading script, off their list of interview questions to ask. So I have had those interviews, and in those situations, you just have to deal with it. But otherwise, it can sometimes be, you can kind of tailor things to, well, you know, this is why I'm so hardworking. I did this project at school, which actually really resonates with your firm's strategy here. And, you know, use these little ties and these stories to be able to make a connection to the firm. And that might end up being a little bit of a conversation. Yeah, and that really ties to your firm strategy here. Like, I've noticed that, you know, for this portfolio company, you were able to really partner with management. And that's something that I really believe in as well. These little ties, and this is not the greatest example, but I think being able to turn
I know
a
what
little
you're
response
saying.
Into yeah. something that's more like a little, you know,
you're
use
constantly,
a little story as
yeah.
a stepping stool.
You're using your story, but then also continually tying it back to the firm somehow in terms of commonalities, in terms of trying to show that you're the right fit for that position. And always coming
Definitely.
Back to how it's prepared you for this specific role, how your stories and how your experience in the past, even if you're, I guess, an undergrad, which is pretty incredible to be able to do that straight out of undergrad. So, Sarah, go ahead.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say that it's sometimes less about how well positioned you are to join the firm.
Mm-hmm.
I think some firms feel some kind of pushback around just overselling yourself.
Yeah.
I would always tie it towards your interest in the firm. And it's almost just like, you know, continue to say really positive things about the firm and turning the overall tone of this interview to leave a really positive impression on the interviewer. Just, oh, well, this kid really, really likes my firm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he or she knows a lot about it. And you know, obviously it's fit. And you almost make them kind of forget whether or not you might be qualified. It's just about, well, this person can definitely do it. You know,
right.
He or she is definitely someone I want to have on my team. And even if he or she is not the smartest person or knows all the things, we can train them. It's fine. You want to leave this kind of impression.
Yeah, it makes sense. You want them to kind of have that connection with you, to actually like you as a person and feel good about.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's critical. You know, you can be the smartest person in the entire process and still not get the job and wonder why. But maybe you didn't
make
the right connection.
Yep, we've had those.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So one last thing before we kind of end it, I guess, actually a couple things. First, would you be comfortable sharing your pay or a range of pay around, you know, base and bonus? Because I think there's not as much around the private equity analyst comp on this versus what's
on
the street.
For sure. So we get paid same as investment bankers on the base side, maybe a bit more actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the bonus side, it's typically a bit less.
So base around 80 to 100 and then or 80 to 90 or 80 to...
Yeah, base is usually like 85 to 100.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then your bonus is a bit less. So this bonus is it's a set bonus. So you're basically
guaranteed
have a target bonus. You can get up to this, essentially.
Got it.
If you do well.
Got it. Okay, and then
but instead of like a, you know, like a big range, like 60 to 80K, the firm will essentially tell you your target bonus is this amount.
Got it. Got it. And it's around 50 to 75% of base or so, or is that typical? Like a range, like.
Yeah, it's probably more around 50 to 60%.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that sounds right. So anything, so what about for you? What's kind of next? Are there direct promotes at the fund you're at? Is it something where you want to stay obviously a few more years, or are you thinking business school? What's kind of next steps for you?
Yeah, so I'm really fortunate to be at a firm where business school isn't really required. And a lot of senior members don't have MBAs.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a program where analysts typically get directly promoted to associates and then go up the ladder as long as you perform. And so my current plan is to just keep on working at my current firm. I mean, it's been a good experience so far. The people are really, really nice and they genuinely care about you.
Maybe you'll be a lifer
there.
We
recently had...
Maybe that'll be your career for 20 years. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? We definitely actually have had some analysts who started at the firm
mm-hmm.
out of undergrad, and they have gone on to become managing directors.
Wow, that's crazy. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really crazy. I would say at least half the firm had been here for more than a few years. So that's
a great
really
sign.
Good culture, because it just means that everyone wants to make sure you're living your best life while you're contributing to the firm. So it's definitely a really great culture here. And I've, comparing this with my time in banking, I can certainly say that when banks talk about good culture, it's really a lip service. Mm-hmm. When PE firms talk about good culture and you can actually feel it, that's very, very important.
Interesting. Well, I really appreciate all the time you've taken. It's gone longer than usual, but you had a lot of interesting things to say. So I really appreciate you sharing all of your wisdom with the listeners here and joining us. So thank you.
It was my pleasure. Yeah, I know this is a very obscure space, and there really aren't that many firms with analyst programs, period.
Yeah, so it's really helpful to get
it. So when I got here, I felt like there was definitely a lot of prep that I had to go through, and some amount of luck and hoping that I just get the offer. So it's been definitely been a great experience.
Living the dream. I think it's incredible. It's incredible. It's what a lot of people want to do. So congrats on everything.
Well, better hours at least.
True. All right. Well, take care. Thanks so much. And thanks to you, my listeners at Wall Street Oasis. If you have any suggestions whatsoever, please don't hesitate to send them my way, patrick@wallstreetoasis.com. And until next time. We'll be right back.